how do you take the sort of time-tested good ideas that just don't feel trendy, like your old pair of sweatpants? I will give you a great metaphor, man. Well, in the last 2 months in Corona, I go out sometimes wearing sweatpants. I go out wearing my busted up sweatpants and my busted up t-shirts and my backwards hat and my freaking cracked Ray-Bans. And I go out there and nobody looks any weird. You know, I'm wearing a mask too, so I look like Cobra Commander on a bender. But like, you know, I'm just living my life. And I think that is the answer.
Auxoro is a media platform designed to help you think better, create engaging conversations, and inspire you to live with purpose, aka do dope shit. We host podcasts like the one you're about to listen to, make videos, write articles, and share the work of interesting people. Whether we speak with doctors, designers, athletes, or music artists, we know that this conversation will leave you with a different perspective, and we hope that this conversation inspires you to live a more fulfilling life. If you'd like to keep up with all things Auxoro, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and subscribe to our twice monthly newsletter. In this action-packed email, we send you the latest Auxoro content, as well as articles, podcasts, books, shows, and other content we find exciting and useful. Go to auxoro.com or visit the link in the podcast description to join over 1,000 others who get the newsletter. Also, you can now support Auxoro on Patreon for $2, $5, or $10 per month. On Patreon, you get early access to all podcast episodes, discounts on merchandise, and one Patreon exclusive episode each month. We're an independent platform with no outside investors, and we rely on listeners like you to keep the conversation going. Go to patreon.com/Auxoro to become a patron, and thank you for the support. This time, I sit down with Dave Rubin, host of The Rubin Report and author of Don't Burn This Book, Thinking for Yourself in an Age of Unreason. I'm a fan of The Rubin Report, so I was honored to have the opportunity to sit down with Dave virtually. In this episode, we got into how to deal with people that offend you, the underlying unity of the three flashpoints that caused Dave to leave the left, why conservatives need a head of fashion and design, the beauty of politics, and more. Without further ado, please enjoy this deep dive with Dave Rubin. I'll start off with a question that someone actually asked me a similar question the other week, and I thought it was a good way to start.
Great.
So if I were to ask your husband how you were doing, what would he say?
All right, wait, are we started?
Yes.
Oh, we're officially started. Okay.
Officially started, yes.
Oh, okay. You want to ask me the question again, then I'll get in question mode.
Sure, sure. If I were to ask your husband how you're doing right now with the book release and everything going on, what would he say?
I think he would say I'm doing shockingly well, actually. You know, I'm pulling crazy long days of talking, which, you know, it's not like chopping wood and it's not like, you know, working in a steel mill or something, but there's a certain mental taxation. There's a certain physical taxation. You could probably hear my voice is starting to get a little hoarse. Yesterday morning, I was up. My day started at 3 a.m. because I was doing a hit on Fox and Friends, which is on the East Coast, at 6:30 or so. So I had to get up at 3 a.m. here. I didn't finish doing interviews till 8 p.m. So literally 3 a.m. to 8 p.m. with, you know, tiny little breaks. I try to grab a little food when I can. But everything being equal, it's like the book is doing incredibly well. We're at the top of every relevant political list. You know, I've got an army, a coordinated army of trolls and haters from Reddit and Discord and everywhere else that are just trying to assault our Amazon reviews and the rest of it. Which, I mean, it's the thesis of the book that you don't bow to the mob. Mm-hmm. And I called the book Don't Burn This Book, not thinking that people were going to literally burn it like we were in 1941 Germany. But a new type of book burning is when a mob sees something they don't like, a speaker who says something they don't like, a book that contains ideas they don't like, a comedian who tells jokes they don't like. What do? They bombard them on social media. They try to wreck Amazon reviews. They try to wreck Apple reviews. And the rest of it. So they're actually doing exactly what I predicted in the book. So I would say everything's actually just fine. It would be nice if I could go to the beach, but I'm stuck here in California where I can go in my backyard and that's the best you get.
So everything's going on as planned then. You predicted it.
Yeah. I mean, here we are. I think it's just fine, actually. I mean, look, the important thing is the people who are actually reading the book, I get a sense that they're really enjoying it. I'm getting a lot of emails from people who are saying, you know, Dave, I don't agree with every single position that you lay out, but I see why you think the way you think, and we can agree to disagree. And that was the whole point. I mean, look, the subtitle is Thinking for Yourself in an Age of Unreason. I'm not trying to convince you that I'm right about every single freaking public policy. I want you to think about them seriously yourself. And if you come to a different conclusion, let's hash it out. That's called being an American.
That's a good segue, because speaking of things that you don't agree with, I grew up as a baseball player, played all through college. And throughout that process, if you want to be a good baseball player, you have to learn from coaches that you don't agree with. And there's a lot of coaches that are assholes. A lot of coaches you find things offensive, you don't agree with. And there are a lot of great coaches too. And I actually saw Kevin Kelly posted an article on 68 bits of advice that he would offer, the founder of Wired Mag. And number one was learn how to learn from those you disagree with or even offend you. So I was wondering for you, who is someone that has offended you in the past or maybe even continues to offend you that you have learned something from and that you can actually take something away and say, hey, like, I may not like this person, but they showed me this.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. You know, it's interesting because I don't get offended easily. So it's hard for me to say somebody that I got offended by that I learned something. Mm-hmm. So I think a different way I can answer that is there have been plenty of people who have said things that I disagree with on the show that I learned from. I think that would be the best way. It's almost impossible to truly offend me in that regard. And when people, you know, when the trolls or something, when they just say like a bunch of awful nonsense about me or lie about me, it's like, you're not really offending me. It's like a little annoying to have to read that and then I just mute you or block you. But I don't really care about that. But in terms of hearing ideas counter to what I believe, I actually really love that. And one of the things that I write about in the book is that moment that I had Larry Elder on the show, and I started just saying stuff that I thought was true just because you hear it everywhere on mainstream media, like talking about systemic racism and how racist America is. And Larry Elder, who's a conservative who happens to be black, he was born here in LA, he's been fighting these noxious lies for decades now. And in effect, he beat me senseless over facts. Mm-hmm. He just beat me and beat me and beat me. And when I finished the interview, you know, I was pretty depressed and banged up. And I was like, whoa, what just happened there? And I walked into the control room. This is before we were totally independent. Mm-hmm. And there were a bunch of producers and directors in there. And they said, Dave, we're cutting that. Don't worry. We're not going to put that up. And I was like, guys, look, if I'm a decent interviewer, that was the real moment. Like, I know I don't come off looking great, but that guy just laid out statistics and real facts about reality. And if we cut that, then what the hell am I doing with my life? And, you know, we put it up and suddenly the next day I saw it got cloned and sent across YouTube and Twitter and everywhere and millions of views. Mm-hmm. And it was all Larry Elder destroys libtard Dave Rubin and, you know, that kind of thing. But what I quickly realized was all the people watching were going, holy cow, you know, I kind of thought like Dave too. And my world has now been opened up a little bit. And that was one of the defining moments for me of, you know, if you listen to people who say things that you don't agree with, if they know something more than you, you might learn something. And maybe you know something more than them. And that's the beautiful dance that we can do as humans. So you got to learn from people you don't agree with.
That seems to be something that a lot of people don't get, that you can actually work on making yourself harder to offend. That's a skill that you can put yourself in uncomfortable conversations. And I'm the same way. I try to make myself as hard as possible to offend. You know, me and a lot of people that I work with in podcasting and the creative space, we tell jokes and say things that would offend a lot of people, but we hear it all the time. And you can actually put yourself in a position to control how offended you are. So when you say, oh, you offended me, you have the power over how you are taking that in. It's not that other person is saying, because what about the other person who hears the same thing and isn't offended? What is it that they're doing differently?
It's an inside job, man. You know, I used to do stand-up for 12 years in New York, and I do stand-up now sometimes when I'm on other tours. If I have an open night, I'll just do whatever the local club is. And I don't even really prepare. I just get up there and have fun with the crowd. And, you know, because, you know, I can draw now. So if they put my name up, it's like people that like me come. So then we just kind of have fun up there. But one of the things that I always believed in stand-up, I loved getting heckled. I never minded it. I'm not kidding, ever, because I always thought, well, now there's an opportunity for me to think on my feet. So if somebody goes, you're not funny, or you're a hack, or whatever they might, I don't like your shirt, you know, whatever. It's like, man, now we're doing something real. We're doing something real. So can I now be funny in the face of that? And, you know, what's the point of being funny? The point of being funny is to tell people the truth. But, you know, if you just run around telling people the truth all the time, you're probably going to get punched in the face. So a good joke or the idea of humor is you're going to say something true, but you do it in a way that elicits a laugh. So then you can start thinking. That's why the greatest comics, you know, if you think about the great comics ever, Richard Pryor, Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, it's like, what were they doing? It's not just that they were funny, but you left there and you go, holy cow, I just thought about a whole bunch of stuff. So I always kind of incorporated that into everything that I'm doing. So the idea that someone would yell at me, you know, from the audience, well, first off, I got the mic too. So it's like, if you're going to beat me while I'm holding the mic, then I'm really in the wrong line of work. But I would see other comics that would get heckled and then would just start screaming at somebody. And it's like, what business are you in? Are you, you know, like, are you in the comedy business or are you in just like the muscle business? I don't know.
Yeah. And that's the point of comedy. You're trying to push the boundary. And when I go to a comedy club in New York, I know that most of the time I'm watching unpolished work that a comedian's trying to work on for maybe a future special or a larger segment, and that they're going to consciously try to push the boundaries. And yeah, sometimes they go too far, but the audience lets you know that. So it's like a game back and forth of like, all right, I'm going to say some shit. Some of it might be offensive, some of it not be, but in a year from now, I'm going to have this super polished thing on Netflix, but now we're just talking.
Yeah. And, you know, part of the reason that actually a lot of comedians now, I know Rogan does it, and I'm pretty sure Dave Chappelle does it. They don't allow phones in the crowd anymore because it's like, you're working through this stuff. That's like, you know, the strange thing about stand-up and why so many stand-ups are sort of bananas is that, you know, most art, it's like if you're in a band, you can practice in that garage for months before you do that show, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a painter or a sculptor or anything else, you can craft your piece separately and then you present it in a gallery. Stand up, imagine being up there, you got to paint the canvas in front of everybody, but not just present it at the end. Every time you put a stroke on that canvas behind you, you got to be like, hey guys, reaction. Yeah. Was that the right one? And it's like, you're trying to build something. And I think that in and of itself lends itself to a certain amount of crazy because you have to practice. And you know, the whole point of being a comic is you got the line here, the line of what is acceptable. Well, you want to get pretty damn close to that line, but we see it all the time. Sometimes you're going to trip over. And if you're going to let the mob destroy you because of that, you're probably in the wrong business.
So you describe three flashpoints in your book that led to the breakthrough moment of you seeing the left as no longer liberal. Those three moments were Cenk Uygur's attack on the conservative commentator David Webb, Ben Affleck's meltdown against Sam Harris on Bill Maher, and the Charlie Hebdo attacks. For you, what do you see as the underlying unity between all three of those flashpoints?
Love that question. So instead of having to tell all three stories again, which I've been telling repeatedly, hopefully people can read the book
they can check this out.
There you go. All the stories are in there. So the unifying principle of those three stories is that what I saw happening on the left was that there were really complex issues that we should be able to talk about, that instead of talking about those complex issues, the left just decided to label everybody bigots and racists and homophobes and the rest of it. So that is the through line through those stories. So the Affleck story where Bill Maher and Sam Harris tried to explain that you could be critical of ideas and without being bigoted towards people. And what did he say? You're gross and racist. And he did it while he was screaming and the whole thing. The Charlie Hebdo one, it's like, people should be allowed to make whatever art that they want and should not be killed for it. But suddenly I saw lefties saying, no, maybe let's not just upset those people. They don't want us to draw those things. Well, it's like, if you say, okay, well, they're telling us not to draw those things or they're going to kill us. Are they okay with the gay bar in your neighborhood? Probably not, but you're supposed to be for gay rights and a series of other things. And then the David Webb one, which is David happens to be a black conservative. And I saw a bunch of colleagues talking about him, and he's a black man who was saying things that they didn't like. So they felt that that gave them a license to call him a bigot and a racist and a self-hater and a grifter and an Uncle Tom and all of the worst things in the world. And I thought, well, wait a minute. You guys are calling everyone racist all the time, but you're racist. You're actually racist because how dare this black man say something that you don't like, oh, tolerant liberal one. I would say the unifying principle of those things is that there are seriously complex things that we have to discuss mm-hmm. in this world, whether it's actually about racism or whether it's about separating ideas from people or whether right now how we're talking about opening up the economy. It's like we've got here in California, it's like we're shutting down the beaches. That's it. Well, of course, it's a progressive governor doing that when instead he could be doing something honest, which is saying, hey, instead of shutting down the beaches, they can be at half capacity. You have to leave a space in between your car in the parking lot and the car next to you. We're going to delineate areas in the sand for groups of four. And they're going to be like, that would be a mature way to have mm-hmm. a conversation. But it's very consistent with progressive ideology that instead of doing anything maturely, honestly, how do we come to these conclusions? Bernie, you just make up $15 minimum wage instead of show. I've run a business. I know that that's not the way a business mm-hmm. should be run, that you just make up how much people should be paid. Bernie's never run it, but he says it because it sort of sounds morally right. And that's what they do with virtually every topic there is. And so the through line is we got to be able to talk about things in a complex way, and that's going to upset some people.
Hey guys, I wanted to interrupt this episode real quick to let you know that Auxoro also produces a short form podcast called The Aux. The Aux brings you a daily dose of uncensored wisdom to jumpstart your life. 10 minutes or less, no bullshit, no topic off limits. You can subscribe to the show by searching The Aux, A-U-X, wherever you listen to podcasts. For all the latest Auxoro content, you can follow us on Instagram at Auxoro, Twitter at AuxoroMag, and hit us up for our twice monthly newsletter with the link in the podcast description. Now, back to the episode.
Okay, so I'm going to take a little bit to build up to this next question. I just want to lay out some things.
Take it away.
So I was reading about Christopher Wiley and Cambridge Analytica, the whistleblower for Cambridge Analytica. And Wiley talks about the connection between fashion and politics, how the style and trendiness and appearance of an idea is just as important or even more important as than the idea itself, because you have to get someone to accept an idea in order for it to take hold. And I'm recording this from Brooklyn, where everything you eat and wear is about trends. I believe you're in LA. Another yeah. Things on the coast tend to be more trendy. And right now, hate speech, transgender issues, anti-gun are very trendy on the coasts. And people on the left take positions and want people to know about these positions, almost like a nice jacket you put on from All Saints. Like mm-hmm. you want to show off your position. And many on the center and right tend to hold these secret positions for fear of being outed, like an old pair of sweatpants that you wear around your apartment, but you wouldn't be caught dead walking around with them on the street. And so, for example, people send you letters and ask you not to out them. So
yeah,
it's my opinion that conservatives and people that aren't on the left, even more towards the middle, have done a terrible job at making their views trendy. Do you agree with that position? And if so, what can people that aren't on the left do to make their positions more fashionable to where it's like a something people want to be caught wearing?
Dude, that is a great lead into a question. I love that because that's a different angle on so much of what I talk about. So first off, I'll tell you, I was born in Brooklyn before it was hipster Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. So I was born in Brooklyn, lived in Brooklyn for 3 years. Then I grew up in Long Island. I lived in Manhattan most of my life. I went to SUNY Binghamton, upstate New York, and then I moved here 7 years ago. So it's kind of funny because I'm a true, true New Yorker. And the only other place that I've lived in New York is LA. And yet my message and the things that I talk about is actually liked much more in the middle of the country. And in many ways is hated by the people in the coast. Mm-hmm. Not everybody, of course, but broadly speaking. So that's an odd thing for me that I've tried to figure out what really is the reality of how that thing happened. One other thing on Brooklyn, you know, Brooklyn for now, where it's this hipster place and very expensive, and you're right, there's so much virtue signaling mm-hmm. and we have barbecues in Brooklyn that, you know, it's $50 for a piece of brisket and all of that stuff. It's like Brooklyn became something that is so deeply different than what the ethos of Brooklyn once was. The idea of like the Brooklyn Dodgers and that it was this like lower class working place that my dad grew up in and my grandparents and great grandparents were in, that when they had next to nothing. And it was all of these families that had come mostly from Europe with, you know, the same old story with just the bag and nothing else. And there were Italians and Greeks and Jews and Irish and Black people. And everyone was sort of struggling together. Everyone kind of lived together, may have had problems together, all of those things. It really was, there's a reason that Brooklyn, that so many people, famous, important, relevant people in fashion and music, in comedy, mm-hmm. came from that. There really is a real reason for that. So when I see like the sort of new age hipster Brooklyn thing, it's like an odd thing. Maybe that's just the way things evolve. But mm-hmm. but to your point directly about how do you take the sort of time-tested good ideas that just don't feel trendy, like your old pair of sweatpants, I will give you a great metaphor, man. Well, in the last 2 months in Corona, I go out sometimes wearing sweatpants.
Yeah.
I go out wearing my busted up sweatpants and my busted up t-shirts and my backwards hat and my freaking cracked Ray-Bans. And I go out there and nobody looks any weird. You know, I'm wearing a mask too, so I look like Cobra Commander on a bender. But like, you know, I'm just living my life. And I think that is the answer, that somehow the left did the All Saints jacket thing really well. And this mm-hmm. is not a knock on All Saints. I've got some All Saints shirts. Mm-hmm. This is,
love All Saints.
How am I doing here? This is Ted Baker. I kind of like this I feel perfect. Like they fit really well. Not bad, right? But I've got some All Saints. Yeah. So this isn't a knock on All Saints. But your point was they figured out how to put on a jacket that looks right, but it doesn't necessarily mean that what's in the jacket or the production of the jacket or anything else is fine. So again, we're not making this about All Saints, mm-hmm. but that concept, right? And what the right, I think, did right was that they did get the ideas basically right, mm-hmm. the ideas of individual rights, of freedom, of getting the government out of the way, of getting personal responsibility. It's your life, capitalism, competition, all of those things. They did that right, but they didn't do the sales job because mm-hmm. I think they were so into the idea portion of it that they didn't realize, oh, we got to win a culture war too. And that's why we see this disconnect right now, because the left said, our ideas I don't know that they fully said this, but I think in essence what happened was, our ideas aren't that great. Let's just paint them up, get all the celebrities to buy in on all of this, call half the country racist and deplorable. And what does all this stuff do? Well, it's all about high taxes and moving money and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. We'll virtue signal the hell out of all of it and it'll come shiny. But look what has happened. That entire thing has started to collapse. We didn't even have a host at the Oscars because the Hollywood liberal elite, No idiot comedian was willing to subject themselves to the outrage mm-hmm. mob that was going to come with it. So I think the right has a branding issue that you're probably right. They could use a couple kind of cool people to come in and be like, guys, the word conservative doesn't sound right. It doesn't sound right. Like progressive, oh, I'm for progress. That's fun. Mm-hmm. We're for progress, even if it doesn't mean anything. But conservative sounds old. It sounds like you're in a smoking jacket and you're talking like this to other people who are talking like this. So I think there is a branding issue. And I suspect, because right now there is actually a lot of creativity and comedy coming out of the right, that thing will be addressed.
Yeah, it's almost like the conservatives need a chief design officer or a chief yeah. fashion officer to step up and say, all right, guys, we have the ideas, we have the utility, we know it works, we have the base of the jacket. Now we just need to make it look good and give it some flair so people want to walk around with it on and want to show other people that they believe what they believe.
You know, what's interesting about that actually is I think there's a reason that doesn't happen, which is that on the right, because people believe in the individual, it may be a little harder to wrangle that. So it's like, if I go to a libertarian conference, it's like you could sit around a table with 10 libertarians and what will always happen is you will have 10 different opinions on driver's licenses, right? One guy, get rid of them. One guy, have them. One guy, have some, have, you know. So it's harder if you're based in individuality to wrangle it versus the left is based in collectivism, and collectivism sort of is like, oh, I wear a jacket, thus here I am. And that would be like, you know, when I was in fifth grade and Champion sweatshirts were super cool. And it was like, oh, if you put on a Champion sweatshirt and went to school, it was like, everyone knew you had a Champion sweatshirt. That kind of says something about you. And I think the left has definitely done that better.
Well, I think part of the crossover or part of the initiation that could bring some of that branding into the center and into the right is a crossover into pop culture and getting, you know, maybe music artists involved or designers involved, creatives involved. And I was thinking about one of my favorite music artists is Post Malone. And I don't know how you feel about him, but I think, you know, he's a fashion icon. He makes great music. But one of the things that people don't talk about is that he grew up in Texas. He owns guns. He raps about guns. He has bodyguards strapped with him all the time. It's pretty safe to say that his life is made safer by guns. So let's assume 6 months from now that Post Malone comes on the Rubin Report, goes on Ben Shapiro, makes the rounds on the intellectual dark web chat series. Let's assume that happens 6 months from now. What in the world would have to happen and what behind the scenes would have to happen for Post Malone to do that?
Well, first off, I do know who Post Malone is. It's not exactly my thing. I listen to mostly like Sinatra and Dean Martin and Frankie Valli.
Yeah. Or maybe just pop culture in general. Of Post Malone as just like a bridge to pop culture.
No, well, I think we're seeing it happen because I do think you're right. And that gets to what I'm saying about how the left owned culture and you can't just win ideas. And, you know, there's a meme out there of sort of politics is downstream from culture. I think Andrew Breitbart was the original one who said that, meaning that if you just have all the ideas right, but you don't have the mechanism to get those ideas out there, you're kind of screwed. So I think what could happen here, I mean, we can use Post Malone as this. Look, Kanye went on Rogan. But they actually didn't air that. But, you know, Elon Musk went on Rogan.
I didn't know that.
So they didn't air it. I don't know what exactly happened there. But Elon Musk went on Rogan. Elon Musk also made the Tesla and has done all sorts of super cool stuff with SpaceX and a whole bunch of other things. We've seen what I meant to say about Kanye was Kanye, you know, came out as a Trump supporter. That, like, put a chip in the whole monolithic structure of how we're all supposed to think about these things. The more of these people that stand up and say what they believe and come onto these shows and talk about these things, the more that the thing will crumble. Because I don't think anybody really likes, I don't think anyone that really is thinking really likes the ideas of what the left has become. You know, that's the irony. Leftism has been so adopted by Hollywood and by musicians and actors and all this stuff. But, you know, what is a musician? What is an actor? What is an artist? You're supposed to be the ultimate individual. You're supposed to put out something cool because it's new and it can make people feel something. When you look at a great new painting, when you hear a beat that you haven't heard before, like that is from the individual. It is not from the collective. That doesn't mean that there isn't a team of people that are synthesizing it all together and all of it, but they're all adding in their own individual pieces to get that thing to be right. That's a beautiful thing. That is much more of a free market, individual-based principle than what's coming out of the left. So in many ways, the Hollywood left is against itself. And I think there's a reason for it. It's like they purport to be for all these things because all of these things purport to be good. But in effect, when the day ends, it's like, yeah, they want low taxes. They got a lot of money. They're a business, by the way, and I don't begrudge them that.
What is your favorite Jordan Peterson story that you can say on a podcast?
So my truly favorite one I can't say on a podcast because I've never said it publicly and I'm sure I will one day, or when Jordan comes back, I would love to talk about it with him publicly on camera. But one that I did not include in the book that I think really does sum up everything about Jordan. I think at one time I had a few sentences about it and then we cut it at the end. We were in Dublin and, you know, when you do these big theater shows, the artist, you know, we would do the show and then there's a Q&A after and a meet and greet and all that stuff. So you usually don't get out of the theater till about 2 hours after the show, but there's still an artist entrance on the side because they don't want you walking out the front where you're going to be mobbed. And in Dublin, it was in a very packed area. It was a very thin little sidewalk there. And we walked out and there was two guys standing about 20 feet away from us. One was probably in his 20s somewhere and the other one was probably in his early 60s. And we saw that they were kind of hugging and they were both crying and they both immediately ran right towards us. And, you know, Jordan's there and his wife and the tour manager and me. And it turned out that they were a father and son who had had a falling out about 5 years ago and had not spoken in 5 years. And they both had bought the book, 12 Rules for Life, and by coincidence had both come to the show. They saw each other at the show. They had started getting their lives together and they reconnected. And they stood there with tears in their eyes. Jordan began to tear up. The tour manager began to tear up. I began to tear up. And then they said things that I won't repeat, but it was such the perfect example of Jordan wrote this book that did so much freaking good. The amount of people that quit doing drugs, quit doing whatever their bad habits are, stood up with their shoulders back, cleaned their room, all of these things. It's like, I saw it happen in real life. I'll give you one more. I think we were in Stockholm and a young guy who was running the jet bridge for the airplane. We were sitting in the first row. He runs in and he was a young black guy. He says, Mr. Peterson, or Dr. Peterson, I could get fired if they knew I was on the plane right now, but I just have to tell you, I bought 12 Rules for Life 2 months ago. It completely changed my life. I stopped all this stuff. I have a better relationship with my girlfriend. I got this job because of it. I've only been here for 2 weeks, but I love it. My life is better, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, everyone on the plane is looking like, who the hell is this guy in the front that this guy is talking to? But I saw so many examples of that sort of thing. And it's like, it's real. It's not just words he put on a piece of paper to sell some books. It really changed people's lives.
And I think it's cool that he takes the time. And I know because you talk about it in your book, but how he appreciates every interaction with fans and he actually takes it in. It's not just, you know, he smiles for the photo and then he's a different person when everyone goes away. He genuinely appreciates and tries to put himself in the mindset of, I'm going to try to be on in front of my fans as much as I can.
I never saw the guy be rude to a fan. I never saw him not shake a hand. I never saw him not stop. He would repeat people's names, which is something I've really tried to do also. I always really liked it. Mm-hmm. He would say to somebody, what's your name? They would say, you know, my name's John. He would say, John, it's nice to meet you. I always try to do that now because there's something very human about it. And I think a lot of people think that the guy, like he was Jesus, but he wasn't Jesus. Yeah. He isn't Jesus. He never wanted to be Jesus. There is, you know, no other Jesus. So I think he did something truly, truly special. And the irony is that all he did was put his thoughts out there and try to fight for them, honestly, which is something we all should be trying to do.
So repeating people's names works. If you're trying to remember someone's name in a conversation, if you say, you know, it's great to meet you, Dave, that will help you remember it more.
Well, I think that actually is true, but it wasn't even that he was trying to remember the people's names. Mm-hmm. It just shows a moment of like, I see you. I see you as a human being. Hey, Dave, how are you? I see you. So it was just like that little sort of thing. And when I do stand up now, we do meet and greets. I always try to do it now because it's like, just for a moment, what's your name? You know, they'll always say something nice to me. I've heard a lot of nice things. That's great. But it's like, what's your name? What do you do? You know, like something like that.
That's something I definitely need to get better at. When you have a podcast, obviously you know the person who's coming on, but just in a normal conversation, people will tell me their name. And as I'm shaking their hand, I'll literally black out from their name.
Yeah.
So sometimes I try to give them a funny nickname in my head. Like if some guy is named Phil and he's overweight or something, I might be like, all right, Fat Phil in my head. I'm going to remember that. But there's a lot of times where I just black out immediately. So I'll try to use that trick.
There you go.
So while you're on the road with Jordan Peterson, you're also, I'm assuming, working on your book and you have your own show behind the scenes and you're doing a lot of things that are taking up a lot of time. And I imagine your focus is going in and out during that span. So how do you restore lost focus? What are some things that work for you to restore lost focus?
You know, I think the most important thing was Jordan said to me right at the beginning of the tour, if we're going to do this, let's give it everything we've got. And again, it was one of those slogans that we all kind of know. We all kind of know it's right. If you're going to do something, give it everything you got. But we don't all often do it. Like you half-ass some stuff. You maybe aren't as committed as you should be. You quit a little earlier than you should. You leave some, you know, paperwork out of the way or whatever it might be. But Jordan, you know, he took every interview request that he could do. He took, you know, we would travel. We would land in a city. He'd immediately have 80 things to do. And then we got a show and everything else. And whatever. What I tried to do was really, so when we were on the road for extended periods of time, first up, we had pre-taped a lot of my shows. So, you know, I could get away for 3 weeks and we would still have new content. So I never went a week that we didn't put up a show or something like that. I did a lot of, you know, video just from my phone on the road and periscopes and whatever. I loved sharing like the cities with people. You know, if I was in Australia for the first time or in London or Canada, wherever I was, you know, I'm in Sweden for the first time. Sharing the experience with people, I think, really did keep me grounded. It was a reminder of like, whoa, this thing is super cool that I'm doing, and so many people are interested in it. And I never lost perspective that, you know, when you go to these giant theaters and there's, you know, 4,000 seats, and they got that big velour curtain, they're all kind of the same, the big velour curtain. And Jordan would walk up there, and sometimes he'd have a chair, but often not. and he'd have a, you know, he had the attached mic to his face. I used to go up there with the handheld because I like that from stand-up.
Yeah, stand-up comedy.
But it was just like he was one man alone on stage, and I would sit right off the stage, and I was very aware that I had the best seat in the house every night because basically I could see him from sort of behind, and I could see the whole crowd. And it's not that every night you can exactly see the crowd, because some nights, depending on the way the theater is lit, sometimes you really can't see into the crowd. Sometimes you can see everybody. Sometimes it's a really deep audience. Sometimes it's really tall. But I could basically see the crowd, and I could see him, and I could see the guy changing people. So because of that, it kept me very aware, very present all the time. I also realized probably a couple weeks in that this thing was seriously special. That this wasn't like touring with a band, you know, like the hottest band in the world. It's like, there's going to be another hot band in the world. This isn't like touring with a hot comic. There's going to be another great comic. This was something else. Like when the people, this sort of gets to what I was saying before, but when people would come up to us after and say these incredible life transformations that he had instigated, it's like, man, that is something genuinely special. And that's not to say that there won't be someone else with great ideas coming down the pike that can continue to help people flourish. Of course there will be. But when you're in it with someone like that, I was really aware of it all the time. I tried to eat right on the road. I eat pretty well in general. I do some sort of like modified paleo thing, but I'm not like super strict.
You look good.
You know, 43, not bad. But you know, that yeah. I try to do some version of that. So I really tried to eat well on the road. I tried not to drink too much. I mean, we had a running joke with our tour manager who was an ex-comic. He was like, dude, guys, this is the worst tour I've ever been on. It's like, nobody's getting drunk. You guys don't wreck hotel rooms. There's no problems. Literally.
Yeah, he's like, where are the drugs? Yeah, where are the broken TVs?
There were no drugs, no broken TVs, no drapes got caught on fire, no nothing. I mean, literally like the biggest scandal we had the whole time. We were in Edmonton one night and I said we were in Toronto on stage and the crowd went crazy and then it ended up being funny. But like, that was our running joke that like we treated it maturely. And then I think because of that, I think that helped the whole thing kind of flourish. So yeah, not drinking too much. Although usually after the show, I would go to like the hotel bar, have a drink. And often there would be, you know, fans of the show that were from out of town that would be there. And I'd chat with some people, that kind of thing. But, you know, never doing anything that was like too crazy throughout it. I felt this responsibility. It was like, man, this guy's doing something important and I'm a piece of it. So I better do the best I can too.
Yeah. And I imagine that seeing thousands of people in person every night reinvigorates you to want to keep your focus and be on your best self all the time. Because as a creator, especially when everyone's doing things remotely right now, you can see the numbers on your podcast or your article views. And sometimes you get discouraged and you might say, oh, only, you know, 5,000 people read this article. I thought it was going to get at least 10,000, but you don't keep in mind that there are literally 5,000 people that read it. It's not just a number. If you had 5,000 people in front of you reading something, you'd be like, holy shit, that's a hell of a lot of people. So seeing all those people there every night must have been an amazing experience.
Not only that, it's seeing the people physically, but then when you see them all over the world and all over the country, you know, the people who live in Nashville are very different than the people who live in New Jersey. And those are very different than the people who live in Stockholm, who are very different than the people who live in Manchester in the UK. And so when you go to these different geographic places and you go, holy cow, this like truly diverse set of people in all different countries with all different like national ethoses and beliefs, they all are sharing the same thoughts. Doesn't mean we agree on all the political stuff or anything like that, but like, this thing was worldwide, that there was a message that was being sent out. It was like a beacon that was being sent out that people all over the world believed in. And so the more I was around it, the more I realized that it was special.
Is there any city that surprised you in terms of your reaction, where you went into it expecting something different and you're like, oh, you know, they disagreed more than I thought, or they agreed more than I thought they would?
You know, look, well, we got more protesters. If we went to progressive cities, we got more protesters, right? So Portland, Seattle, that kind of thing, were more protesters. The more conservative-leaning cities, there weren't protesters. I would say the most interesting night of the entire tour probably was our second night in Stockholm, Sweden. So Sweden, you know, when the lefties talk about like their utopian America, they always say, we should be more like Sweden. Now, most of them have never been to Sweden. Sweden has all sorts of problems related to free speech and political correctness and a bunch of stuff, to the point that we were supposed to do one show in Sweden. It sold out in 2 minutes. So we did another, and that one sold out in 2 minutes. So when we did the second show in Sweden—
That's rock star status.
Yeah, like crazy. And that's all Jordan. Yeah. That is not me. I assure you that's Jordan. But we did the first show there, and then I think we left to go to Denmark, and then we were coming back to Sweden because we had added this second stop. Mm. And when we were coming back, as we were on the plane, there was an article that the foreign minister of Sweden, she wishes that Jordan Peterson would crawl back under the rock from which he came. I mean, this is the foreign minister of a Western nation saying this about a psychologist coming to speak in her country. Like, totally crazy, right? So we go to that show. The way we did the shows is I would open up with about 15 minutes of stand-up. Jordan gave about an hour and a half lecture, and then we would do a Q&A together. So in my opening, I read her tweet. And it got a huge laugh. They're really politically correct there. So I had to like massage it a little bit. Mm-hmm. But what I could feel in the crowd was they are so starved for someone to tell them the truth that that's why it was so important that we were there. So after the show, I would do a separate meet and greet from Jordan and we would sell it right then and there. So sometimes 20 people would be involved, sometimes 40, but we had to do it kind of quick. So it was just whoever could, you know, buy the ticket right then and there. That night in Sweden, about 100 people bought the ticket. We jammed ourselves into this side room at the theater and I sat at a huge table with about 100 people and I started asking them about Sweden, what's going on here. They started telling me about how they're afraid to say what they think and they have all these problems. And I said, you know what? I've never done this before and I don't know that I'm ever going to do it again, but why don't we literally all get out of here? Is there a bar around here? And let's just all go out to a bar. And we took over a local bar. 100 of us walked into a bar. We stayed for about 5 hours, got pretty drunk, and I got to talk with regular folks, public intellectuals. There was a very famous comedian there, a whole bunch of other people who were experiencing the same things in the world that we experience here in America. And I thought this would be a truly, truly special night.
What is it about Sweden where they feel like it's a treat to hear the truth? Like, is it their laws? Is it the way the country's set up? What's going on?
It's a great, great question. I've had a couple Swedish guests on to expand on it further. The short version of it is that conformity is really valued very high in Swedish culture. So, you know, when you think of Swedish people, you think of sort of like this tall, sort of blonde man and woman, and they're in perfect clothes. And if you walk around Stockholm, everyone looks like they bought their clothes. From a fashion perspective, you would love it. They look like they bought their clothes that morning and they look like they're going to throw them out that night. Everyone's got a perfectly fitted jacket, perfect hair, perfect shave, like everything about them looks kind of perfect. But what lays underneath that is that sort of conformity creates a lot of problem for individual thinkers. And, you know, they have all sorts of problems with immigration and that they brought in, all these new people that aren't integrating that well. And now it's caused this odd political correctness where you're not allowed to talk about it or you're called a racist and a whole bunch of other stuff. And then the other issue that they have is that they have a truly egalitarian society for decades, meaning men and women are completely equal there. Nobody debates that. But one of the things that's happened is as men and women can do whatever they want there, they have still found that men usually like things more. So men become engineers and women usually like people more. So more women become doctors. So even though everyone's allowed to do whatever they want, the social justice warriors aren't happy that there are still more male engineers and more female nurses. So they're still trying to rejigger their society. And I think that causes a lot of problem for people that just want to live their life.
Yeah, because it's like you see a difference and then you want the answer to that difference to be oppression. So then you try to reverse engineer the problem because you know there has to be oppression. It can't just be people like doing different things.
And think about how perverse that is. So Sweden did it right, right? It's the utopia that Bernie and AOC always say we should be like. Everyone's equal there. But still, there are biological hardwired differences. Men happen to like things more. That's not saying men are better. Women happen to like people more. That's not saying women are worse, but they are different. So now the social justice warriors can't even accept the experiment that they wanted didn't come out with the answer that they wanted. So now they want to go in and re-engineer, and that's really dangerous.
Yeah, I think it's going to swing back in terms of people being okay with differences and not always having to try to make it about oppression, because for thousands of years, women being different than men meant that they were second-class citizens. And now we're in a time where women are not second-class citizens, but there are still differences. And so I think as a knee-jerk reaction, there are some people that think, wait, we have to be the same or else we're going to go backwards. But I think now we're at the point where we can celebrate those differences without going back to how we used to be, without retroactive thinking. Like these are the differences and this is a good thing, and we can celebrate those differences and use them to our advantage and not try to make everyone the same.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I mean, I think that might be a little pie in the sky. Like, I think there's a lot of work that has to be done to deprogram a lot of people, but that actually is exactly why I wrote the book.
So would it be fair to say that you find politics more beautiful than the average person because you chose to make your life the way that you chose to live your life and spend your time?
You know,
that you find something beautiful about political discussions and the way that things come together?
I suppose I do find some beauty in it, because if you find people that really think about these things at a granular level, like at a deep level, and have interesting thoughts, even if they're the different specific, their outcomes are different than maybe yours are, that is a beautiful thing. So like, I don't know if you know Michael Malice, but Michael Malice is a really, really interesting, you know, he wrote a book, I have it right here, called The New Right. He's like a sort of ANCAP, no government guy. I call him the Willy Wonka of politics. It's like, he's very quirky, very kind of out there, weird, but like, he's a great, great political thinker that when I have conversations with him on either of our shows, every time it ends, I'm like, man, like, I'm not there on all that stuff with him, but what a fun way of looking at the world. What an interesting, unique way of looking at the world. When I've sat here with Jordan Peterson and talked about all of the things that we've elicited here, when I've debated Ben Shapiro about gay marriage, where he has an Orthodox Jewish perspective on it, or where I'm married to a man, or when I've had Dennis Prager on and he's for the death penalty and I'm against it, or Glenn Beck, who is pro-life and I'm pro-choice. It's like, if you find these people and you know that they know what they think, but they're interested in what you think and you can do that dance, like, what's cooler than that? Like, what's cooler than, why do we find partners in life, right? Like, why do you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend or something? It's like, you want to find somebody who hopefully, I think, kind of sees the world as you see it, but then you don't want them to think exactly as you do. The best, why do opposites attract? It's like, you got one person who thinks about a lot of big sky stuff, and then one person who maybe thinks about things at a lower level. One person's really messy. One person's really clean. It's like, that's what we need to create something cool. And I think as an interviewer, that's definitely the best part of all that. So do I find politics more beautiful? I would say politics is seriously messy. And it's seriously dangerous to only view the world through a political lens. I don't want people to do that. That's really what I write in the final chapter, is if your whole salvation is about politics, you will be endlessly miserable. So you better, if you love fashion, then you better figure out a way to incorporate fashion, but that doesn't mean don't care about politics, because politics will eventually come for you. But if you care about fashion, then that's cool. If you care about sports or video games, whatever you care about, find some way to not just be completely focused on that one thing, because that one thing will burn you out. Like, you could really, really love video games and play video games every day of your life, and you might find out when you're 45 that you miss some other stuff. And I think politics can be the same way.
Yeah, I actually wrote down a quote from the latest Michael Malice interview you did, because I believe you had him on a couple times.
Oh, all right.
And it was from you, and I actually revisit it pretty often, but it was from... I think you said you were at dinner with a friend, or maybe it was just an acquaintance. And at one point in the conversation, you said, do you think you believe what you believe more than I believe what I believe? And he effectively said, yeah, I think I believe what I believe more than you believe what you believe. And to me, that actually signals that you're not ready to have a conversation if you come into an interaction thinking that your beliefs are stronger than what someone else believes. You both, one may be right and one may be wrong, but that other person may think that that answer, the wrong answer, is like part of their being and identity. So you have to recognize that they have like a death hold on that belief.
It was a very important moment for me. Just to clean up the language on it just a tiny bit. You got the core of it right. But in effect, what happened was I went to this bar with a friend who I've known literally my entire life. And we've debated everything always. We've played sports together. We've done everything together always. but I hadn't seen him in a while. He's a big lefty now. He went at me a whole bunch of times, just couldn't stop. And I kept saying to him, you know, could we not do this? Like, you just had a new kid. Like, you want to talk about the Knicks, like anything else. But he just couldn't stop. And I finally said to him, do you believe what you believe as much as I believe what I believe?
Do you think that
I believe it?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. You got me crossed up there. Hold on. Let me clean this up completely. I said, do you think it's possible that I believe what I believe as much as you believe what you believe? Man, it's a hard sentence to say over 20 times. But the point was that I wanted him to see that do you at least think it's possible that I'm being honest? And without even hesitating, he said no. And that gets to what your point was, which is he wouldn't even grant me the chance to say that, oh, what you are is a full human who earnestly believes something. You're either a grifter or a snake or a liar or incompetent or something like that. And I've never done it before, and I hope to never do it again, but I threw the money down on the table, I paid for everything, and I walked out. I've subsequently had a little bit of a mea culpa with him, and we have talked a bit. But that's a pretty damaging thing to say. Like, if you can't admit that your friend could have a bunch of beliefs that are counter to yours, like you can't even believe that they could forthrightly have that says more about you than it says about them.
Yeah. So the highest profile mindset shift that you've gone through is what you cover in the book. You went from the left to holding your ground as a classical liberal. Is there a less high profile mindset shift that you also went through during that time, a behavior habit that you once considered harmless that you now view as harmful? Is there something less high profile that you changed your view on, or something you used to do that you don't do anymore?
You know, I think one of the things, this one will be a little bit messy, I think, but I think it's the most honest way I can answer the question, is that, you know, I try to be as honest as I can always, and sometimes that can come back to bite you. But you know, we all white lie every now and again, or fudge the truth or something like that. One of the things that I really tried to do after being with Jordan for so long, and he would talk about why you shouldn't lie, because in effect, you're distorting reality. You're sending a distorted reality out to the world, and then the world will send a distorted reality back to you. And we live in a weird time with this right now, where it's like, we don't really trust the media. We don't really trust our politicians. Everyone's fighting on Twitter. It's getting increasingly hard to figure out what is real. Like in the midst of Corona right now, it's like, I don't know how many people I actually trust are giving me the right information, or why should I just try? The governor says no beaches. Why should I trust that that's the right thing to do? I think one thing that I've really tried to do in the last 2 years, and this comes from being with Jordan, it comes from writing the book, and it also comes from, I think, bettering my life, is that I really try not to lie. In those moments when, you know, it's like sometimes you lie, and I mean this white lie, like something that's completely unnecessary. Like someone, did you see that movie? And you're just like, yeah, because you're just like moving the conversation forward. I'm really trying not to do that sort of thing. And I know maybe that sounds a little cliche or something, but I think if you really try to do that, that you can fix some of this stuff. So I would say that was a real shift. It's not that I was running around lying to everybody, but by the way, I did have a time in my life where I did do that, and I was in what Jordan would describe as chaos. But I think cleaning that up is a really good step if you can try to do it a little bit more.
Yes, something that's helped me with telling the truth is I have a journal, and in that journal every day you write down two affirmations. So one of the affirmations that I write down often is, I'm someone who tells the truth always. And I still lie, but at least now when I do lie, I think back to that affirmation and it stands out in my mind more. And I'll go back that night and write down, you know, why did I tell my mom I did this? Or why did I tell this girl on a date that I did this when I really don't, to make myself seem better than I am? So like, I think I lie less frequently because of it, but it makes it stand out to me more, where it's like, it raises a flag in my mind as soon as I do it.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's like how you do it. It's not that you just, all of these things, whenever you want to change or better your life, it's not that you just do it tomorrow. It's not like you could be like, all right, I've been doing life this way all this time, and now I'm going to stop smoking pot. I'm not going to watch porn. I'm not going to do like all whatever the hell it is that you're doing. It's not that you got to do it all tomorrow, but you got to at least give yourself a little bit of the framework so that you're able to build the life that you want to build. So when you do that, you probably, when you lie, I'm sure that right after your lie, you're like, why did I do that? Why did I do that? Because I write this thing in my journal every day. Why the hell did I do that? And then eventually over time, I think you probably will train yourself out of it.
Yeah. So I want to get to a point where I think we may disagree or see things a little bit differently as we start to wrap up. So
great.
If there was a meter for how dangerous the left is, I think that I would think that meter is significantly lower than your meter is set at right now. And I recognize that you're at political ground zero, so you have a higher dose of the leftist radiation, and you're constantly getting stuff on Twitter. But for the average person, even in Brooklyn, when I walk around and I talk to people, 99% of people are willing to have a meaningful, open conversation to where I've only maybe met one or two Twitter people in real life, like people that are just, you know, basically avatars for their Twitter account. What would you say to talk me out of my skepticism as viewing the left something not to worry about as much?
Yeah. Well, first I would say that if you're able to, especially in Brooklyn, find those people that disagree with you, that are treating you respectfully, and they're doing that from a leftist perspective, that's freaking fantastic. I would prefer that this problem not be as grave as I have come to believe that it is. But I would also say that I don't think I'm overestimating it, because I have traveled not only with Jordan in the last couple of years, but I do tons of college gigs. I do all sorts of private speaking events. The amount of young people that are college age, but now I'm realizing it's all across the board, because the amount of emails I'm getting about my book, I'm getting emails from 50-year-old mothers of three in Alabama. But the amount of young people, college age specifically, that are just afraid to say what they think. And 9 out of 10 times, and I think I'm even being generous when I say that, 9 out of 10 times, it's because they're saying something against leftist orthodoxy. It's very rare that it comes out of the right. That is not to say it doesn't exist. So of course, if you grow up in a strict evangelical Christian household and you were to tell them that you were gay, most likely they're not going to be thrilled with that. So I am not pretending that the right is perfect or that they don't have their own issues with these sort of things. But the stuff that culture is constantly slamming us with, that which is sort of we've littered throughout this conversation, right? That is coming from the left. And now look, my Twitter bio, as you might know, says Twitter is not real life. So I've always been very aware that the average person and how people behave on Twitter are completely separate things. But you know, we also have to remember that we live in a time, especially now with Corona, where we went from big tech having a lot of control over our lives to now they have pretty much all the control over our lives, because you can't go out and meet your friend for coffee and have an honest political conversation. You have to do it through their pipes now. So I am worried that more of us will fall into the traps of big tech, because it's just the nature of our reality right now. And the other way I would answer this is that the bad ideas of all time, the ideas that have killed endless amounts of millions of people, are socialist collectivist ideas. They, you know, the Nazis were collectivists. All of the places that things go horrifically awry in Venezuela and Cuba and all of the people that have been killed, it's not that they're killed in the name of what's being sold as a bad ideology. They're being sold a utopia, and a utopia never exists, because the only way you get to utopia, you got to kill a lot of people to get there to create your perfect society, because we are imperfect. And the analogy that I always give with this is, I'm guessing you're a Marvel movie guy. Thanos, in effect, so Thanos was a social justice warrior, in effect. Thanos saw a world, a universe of finite resources. And that's true. There are finite resources on this planet. And his solution was, well, no one else is going to do it. I'm the good guy. I'll kill half the universe. That's what I'm going to do, right? I'm going to get the stones. I'm going to throw them in the glove, and we're going to get to town. And I'll be the good guy, right? After he does it, what's the next scene after he snaps it? And then they go in Endgame. The first scene is him just sitting out there in a peaceful, you know, prairie, and everything's okay. But what he had to do was murder a lot of people. And in many ways, that's what the left has become. That on their quest for perfection, which can never be achieved, they will take out a lot of people in the process. So I'm thrilled to hear that you're finding those people to talk to, and I will always extend my hand to those people. What I'm finding right now is it's a hell of a lot easier to break bread with people on the right. But I would, my last thing on this would be, if we could let go of the left-right thing, if we could let go of the liberal-conservative thing, it's like, dude, whatever our differences are, I mean this to you directly, but to anyone listening, it's like, whatever your differences are, as long as you're not trying to force me to live my life another way, and as long as I'm not trying to force you to live it another way, then that's the beauty of America. And I think that that's the message that I want to get across more than anything else, is that we're supposed to think different things, and that actually is okay.
Yeah. Do you have time for me to slip in one more
question? My guy's giving me the signal. So one more. I'll do it quick.
Okay. So if someone listened to all your podcasts, your interviews, listened and read everything you've ever done, the full Dave Rubin catalog, what is it in your life that's influenced you that person might not see or may miss, but the hidden influence that drives you?
Man, you're good. You're good, man.
I steal a lot of podcast questions from better podcasters. So,
yeah. No, that's good.
I try to make them my own.
Well, look, you know, a lot of what I wrote about in the book, you know, especially about stuff being closeted about my sexuality and that sort of stuff, I've never really publicly discussed that stuff before. Mm-hmm. The types of pain that I went in, you know, I living a life, it's hard to live one life as a human being, much less when you're closeted, you're living 2, 3, 4 lives. You know, I did a lot of drugs, I did a lot of shit that I'm not proud of. But eventually, by figuring out who I am, like, I was able to put a lot of that stuff to bed. And that doesn't mean that the ghosts of your past don't haunt you sometimes. I think we all have that. We all go, oh man, that's who I was. That's the shit that I did. You know, and I'm not talking about like highly illegal shit, but just like, that's what I did to my friends and family, or that's what I did to myself. I think that sometimes, man, that I was so hard on myself, you know, like, and I think that writing this book actually has led me to open up about that kind of stuff a little bit more. So when I hear a question like that, I'm like slightly more comfortable talking about it than maybe I would have been a year ago. So we should do this in a year and let's see what happens.
Yeah, let's do it. Well, that would be wonderful. And I'll let you go. Thank you again for taking the time to hop on the podcast. I hope you have Thanos on the podcast one day, do some CGI, get him to ask some questions while he's killing all these people. And good luck with the rest of your interviews. And the book is great. So thank you.
Thanks. Really enjoyed talking to you.
I'll see you later, Dave.
Thanks. That was really great. You're a great interviewer. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. That means a lot. And again, I said, I steal podcast questions from all the podcasters I listen to, which you are definitely in that list and make up a significant chunk of those podcasts. So I just want to thank you for doing what you do.
Nice. Awesome. Well, I appreciate it. Good luck in Brooklyn. And I'm 3 minutes late, so I got to jump.
All right. Thanks, Dave. See you.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Auxoro. If you haven't already, please hit us with a 5-star rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. This helps us appear higher in searches, which means more people will find out about Auxoro. Other ways to help get the word out is telling a friend, tagging us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, writing a blog post, or supporting us with a donation on Patreon. We are a completely independent platform, and we're grateful for every listener who supports this podcast. Thanks for coming along for the ride, and I'll see you guys next time.